Welcome to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. It's good to get together again to provide facts to our community through Zoom technology and our word of mouth. Thank you for listening. I am Pat Schlarbaum, your host for the hour with engineer Mike Murphy. There's a full slate of Local Talk guests in the wings, so to speak. The weather will be mostly sunny today with a high of 81, and summer-like conditions will prevail through the weekend. Highs in the 80s during the day and low 60s at night. Looks like a cold front entering the state Monday with a high of 66. And thunderstorms are possible into Tuesday and Wednesday next week. Let's welcome Dennis Hart, who worked so wonderfully at gathering the news for this week from the pages of our local newspaper.
The coronavirus continued making news on the pages of the Ames Tribune this past week. Let's start with last Friday's paper, which reported that 250 more cases of the virus had been confirmed in Story County. That was the highest number of new virus cases in the county in months, and it brought the total number of coronavirus cases in the county to 12,364 since the pandemic started. The Ames School District reported between 8 and 16 new cases of the virus among its students. Gilbert School District reported 4 new virus cases. Iowa State University reported 12 new cases of the virus among students there. About 63% of Story County residents above the age of 12 were said to be fully vaccinated. There was also word that the Coronavirus Emergency Fund for Story County immigrants had raised more than $360,000 for 123 households since March of 2020. Now, the volunteer-led group has announced it plans to stop distributing rent and utility assistance at the end of the year, or until the money runs out. Organizers said they're closing up shop because of fewer donations and because of a decrease in assistance applications. Over the next months, the Immigrant Fund will reconfigure into an ongoing Story County advocacy group. Last Friday's Trib also reported that a group of Ames High School students is asking the school district to commit to taking action on its goal of preventing climate change. The group is asking the district to increase energy efficiency, reduce waste, and develop chances for students to learn more about climate change, climate literacy, and the impact of sustainable agriculture. The proposal is nearly identical with one that was given to Iowa City Schools 2 years ago and approved there. The Ames School Board has not yet set a date for voting on the plan here. And there was a report about the 4th annual Gilbert Amazing Race, which took place a week ago at Banford Park in Gilbert. It's an adventure race, and 8 two-woman teams took part. They had to do things like pull-ups, rock wall climbs, and get through an obstacle course. Saturday's Trib reported that Iowa State University's student government condemned a lack of student input before a recent Big 12 conference vote to invite Brigham Young University into the conference. The Big 12 invited BYU, as well as the universities of Houston, Central Florida, and Cincinnati, into the conference after Texas and Oklahoma were invited to join the Southeastern Conference. The ISU student government says that the university administration should have expected that BYU's admission to the Big 12 would have a negative impact on LGBTQ+ students. Back in 2016, 25 LGBTQ organizations signed a petition to the Big 12 commissioner asking that BYU be excluded from any league expansion. Until recently, BYU, which is a private Mormon university in Provo, Utah, had banned what it called the expression of homosexual feelings. There was also a report that the drug maker Merck said that its experimental coronavirus pill had reduced hospitalizations and deaths by half in people recently infected with the virus. The company said it would soon ask health officials in the U.S. and around the world to authorize the pill's use. A decision from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration could come within weeks after that. If the drug is approved, it could be distributed soon afterward. There was also word that the city of Ames was urging residents to take part in the annual Healthiest State Walk, which was scheduled this past Wednesday. It was a 1 kilometer walk starting at City Hall. The walk was set to kick off Healthiest State Month, which lasts through October. Sunday's paper reported that the Ames School District has acknowledged that fights have been a problem among students this fall, especially at the high school level. On Monday a week ago, a student at Ames Middle School allegedly damaged 2 classrooms and broke windows on the exterior of the building. A shelter-in-place order was put into effect, and police responded. Early last month, Ames High Principal Valerie Nyberg wrote to school families about 3 incidents of student behavior that had happened at the school the day before and resulted in what she called school-based and or criminal-based consequences. Then, late last month, Nyberg wrote to families that after what she called several student behavior incidents this semester, There had been another fight at school that day. And Interim School District Superintendent Paula Vincent wrote that, in her words, the frequency and repetition of misbehavior is especially troublesome. She said the district was taking several steps, including reviewing student discipline rules and processes, providing additional mental health services, and planning with individual students and families to address specific learning challenges and needs. Also last Sunday, the Trib had a story about why Ames tap water tastes so good. The city's water system has won several awards. The groundwater supply comes from 22 different wells, about a third of which are on at any one time. The city also has what is called moderately hard water, meaning a higher mineral count. That adds some flavor to the water. And the Trib's website had word last Sunday about Iowa State University's football team, which demolished the University of Kansas at Jack Trice Stadium last Saturday, 59-7. Tuesday's paper reported that Iowa State University would host a special in-person commencement ceremony tomorrow at Hilton Coliseum for about 350 graduates who graduated between May of 2020 and August of this year. The ceremony was open to the about 12,000 invitees who had graduated during that time period, but had to go through virtual ceremonies because of the coronavirus pandemic. There was also word that the University of Northern Iowa professor, who was stripped of his ability to teach his plant systematics class because he required students to wear masks in class, says he plans to require masks again next semester, even if it means he'll be fired. Steve O'Kane is still being allowed to teach his online-only class this semester. He is defying the Iowa Board of Regents policy prohibiting mask requirements at universities. There was also word that all 26 kindergarten through 12 public schools in Story County were set to receive two-way public safety radios by the end of this week. Each school will get one radio that runs on the county's public safety radio communications network. The radios will be placed in the schools, serving as an immediate notifier to 911 dispatchers and first responders in the event of an emergency such as a violent intruder. A single button press on the radio will alert other schools, first responders, and 911 dispatchers of an emergency. Wednesday's Trib reported that an informational meeting had ended with a call for Boone County farmers to band together in refusing easement offers to make way for a proposed 2,000-mile pipeline. Summit Carbon Solutions wants to build a $4.5 billion pipeline that would sequester biofuel plants' carbon emissions. But company representatives ran into resistance on Monday at a meeting in Boone's History Center, where many who have land along the pipeline's proposed route took issue with the project. The pipeline would connect to 12 Iowa ethanol plants and pass through four other states: Nebraska, Minnesota, South Dakota, and North Dakota. There was also word that the superintendent search firm hired by the Ames School District has an online survey available through next Friday for community members to give feedback on what they want to see from the district's next leader. Former Superintendent Jenny Reisner resigned last May, and Interim Superintendent Paula Vincent is leading the district for 1 year while a permanent successor is found. Survey results will be given at a presentation to the school board October 26th. A new superintendent is scheduled to be picked next January 21st. And there was a report that a new restaurant and bar had opened on Main Street in downtown Ames. It's Sweet Caroline's Kitchen and Cocktails. It's offering what its owners call home-style comfort food. The new place was formerly home to the Old Main Brewing Company. Large exposed brick walls on the east and west sides of the business show vintage advertising murals that had been painted on the exterior of the adjacent businesses before the construction of the building on Main Street. Yesterday's Trib reported that Iowa Republican senators had rejected the first set of proposed state redistricting maps. The state Senate voted 32-18 along party lines to reject the proposed maps, which would have established new congressional and legislative districts for the next decade. Democrats had argued that those maps were fair and that they removed partisan influence from the redistricting process. Republicans hold majorities in both the Iowa House and Senate, and that gives them the power to accept or reject the maps. Now the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency has to go back to the drawing board and come up with a new set of maps. There was also word that an Iowa grain cooperative that had been the target of a Russian-linked ransomware attack last month was said to be working to recover, with about half its operations again computerized. New Cooperative, a farm service business with headquarters in Fort Dodge, said that more than 50% of its operations are back online. A ransomware group said it was demanding nearly $6 million. Separate from this attack, another ransomware group is claiming it attacked Farmers Cooperative Elevator Company of Arcadia, Iowa. The Trib also reported that the Ames Haunted Forest would open for the Halloween season tonight, and be open every Friday and Saturday night from 7 to at least 11 o'clock through the end of October. The Haunted Forest is on South 4th Street in Ames, across the street from Jack Trice Stadium. And the Trib also had a list of other Halloween events and places in Story and Boone counties, and there are plenty of them. And among the stories in today's Tribune, word that the principal of Ames High School has been removed from her job. Valerie Nyberg had been principal at Ames High for only 15 months. And that is your summary of the week's happenings from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart. Happy to have been with you today, and happy the weekend is just ahead. I'll be right back here on Local Talk on Monday morning at 7, when I'll report on what's been making news around the state. Between now and then, let's both have a great weekend.
There's a place, a place where the sweet winds blow, where the bright streams sing at a hawk teak's wing, and the green woods they still grow. And there's a world where everything's connected deep inside. The bobcat and the bear, the eagle and the hare, from the mountain to the endless rolling tide. And maybe we belong there too.
Thank you, Dennis Hart, with your Week in the News and the music interlude, Doug Wood, In Our Hands. In honor of our next story, recently an 1,100-acre woodland parcel next to the Des Moines River in Boone County, to our west, was put up for sale. The Iowa 4-H camp was purchased by the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation to ensure this pristine woodland and prairie area would remain in public ownership. Last Sunday, a raptor release was held that included rehabilitated birds of prey, or raptors, were released by SOAR, which is Saving Our Avian Resources. Here's Roger Bernard, a volunteer at SOAR, emceeing the proceedings.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the SOAR annual release party. Rather nice to be out in Iowa's beautiful outdoors. We are very happy to have everyone here. Some information on what's been going on at SOAR. So far this year, through the 24th of September, there's been 262 birds come into SOAR, and we're not done with the year yet. Now, I want to introduce the director of Saving Our Avian Resources, or SOAR, Kay Newman, everybody.
SOAR is a nonprofit. We do wildlife rehabilitation and education and research. Everything that SOAR does, we have permits from the Fish and Wildlife Service, permits from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. And so all our facilities are inspected by our game warden. There are lots of rules. And so all the birds that we work with are protected by state and federal laws. And we mostly see raptors coming to us, who are the birds of prey. So the hawks, the owls, the eagles, and the falcons. That's the main group that we work with. And so today we have two screech owls that are ready to release. They'll go first. We have two red-tailed hawks, and we have two barred owls, and we have one bald eagle that will be ready to go, and we'll do the eagle last. That's the lineup for today. And I know that everyone is curious about this location. And so we're going to have Abby with the Heritage Foundation tell you a little bit about what's going on in this location.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon. My name's Abby. I'm the Director of Philanthropy for the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. And I'm here because currently Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation is the owner of this property. A couple years ago, the 4-H Foundation decided with declining camp enrollment that it was time to let go of this property. They weren't going to use it as a camp anymore. They prepared to auction the property. My organization, which has a mission to protect and restore Iowa's land, water, and wildlife, made an offer to purchase the whole of the camp rather than see it be parceled up and auctioned off. So we were so grateful and so excited when we got word that, yes, our offer had been accepted. And we were able to purchase this camp, and now we're working with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources to make this become a public area. So this is going to be a phased process. Right now, the camp property is closed to the public, so it's kind of special that you guys get to be out here, but the plan is to kind of phase it in. And then we're going to have Derek talk a little bit more about that, but I wanted to just let you know that Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation is, like SOAR, a donor-based organization. If you're interested in joining our organization to protect wild spaces in Iowa, to make public parks available for the people here in our state, then we'd love to talk with you.
Hi everyone, Derek Miner. I'm a land stewardship associate with the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. So I work across the state managing land that is owned long-term by the foundation for the benefit of the land, the water, and the wildlife. And part of that is this camp. So I thought I'd tell you about the long-term plan, or what we know about that long-term plan right now for this place. So 1,000 acres, a little more. Most of that will go to our partners, the Iowa DNR, and it will become public land for recreation and to protect the wildlife. And our partners in the DNR are still trying to figure out exactly what this place will be in their ownership long term. So it's just great that it's protected all together as one contiguous piece. It's going to tie in with the Sailorville Wildlife Management Area along the Des Moines River corridor, which just creates this awesome connected corridor in this great place. And then INHF, the foundation, we also intend to retain about 300 acres of the camp to manage that long-term in that ownership. And the whole area, though, will be managed connected. So we're going to work with our partners. They're going to work with us to make sure we're doing the best we can for this place. You notice the cabins, the lodge, all the buildings, the infrastructure that was here for the camp, that will likely be removed. And it will be restored into a wildlife area. So they'll work on planting this to native grass, getting the most diverse habitat we can out here on the land. And so we're kind of in a transitional phase. It's kind of sad to see the camp go away, but we're transitioning and kind of restoration of this place. People coming out in a different fashions. It's kind of cool to be a part of that. I'm starting to look for the next 40 years, the next 100 years, and what that'll look like. And it'll be really neat, I think. So we purchased the property about 2 years ago. That summer, in August, the derecho came through. And as you can see, some of our woodlands were greatly impacted by the derecho. It was terrible. We came out here and saw the damage, almost had us in tears over all the trees that were damaged and what this incredible woodland once was, a natural disaster came in and has changed it. I think the derecho will also create opportunities for a new story to happen within the composition of our woodlands, the habitat type, and hopefully with a little bit of our stewardship help, we can use the derecho as a positive impact. So that's a quick synopsis of what's going on here. I'm just excited to see the next chapter happen and have the whole piece connected as one contiguous piece. And it's going to be really good for this area here in Boone County.
Anybody a former camp staffer here? Woo, I got one. Yay! Well, my name's Terry, and I'm a former camp staffer, former program director here. As a former staffer and program director out here, I was lucky enough to live here and start to raise our kids out here. My son counting butterflies, learning how to count, and learning his bird calls so he could identify the barred owls at night and the cardinals and the nuthatches and the chickadees. All of the children that we worked with as staffers out here really meant a lot. And what we learned here and what we were able to share with other people is incredibly important for the planet and for Iowa. And I want people to know that without the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, this place probably would have been carved up into lots of little lots. And we are so grateful for the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation to save the 4-H camp and its natural habitats, 1,100 acres. But I also have to name drop Jim Pease, because without Jim Pease from Iowa State University, who was a great mentor to a lot of people who worked out here, this place wouldn't have been saved and protected. So shout out to Jim Pease and Judy Levings and the Natural Heritage Foundation.
Okay, Randy Farnham, tell us about your experiences at the 4-H camp as you were becoming a young grown-up.
As I was becoming a young grown-up. that was a great time in our life, and Terry was part of that too. The amount of, like you said, growing up that we did in those couple of years at the 4-H camp was phenomenal. Changing from kind of directionless young man, having willy-nilly going all over the place, to finding out that I really love working with kids. And that's what I've been doing in the public school system for the last 20 years. But what we found is living out in that area, living out in the woods itself, you know, out in our little cabin of cedar, we just built such strong friendships and with other people that got into leadership positions all over the state. It's a great group of people to work with and to influence me and the directions that I took.
And I recall you were part of the kitchen staff crew. You were the guy that came slogging out. Maybe you can describe that whole performance of encouraging people to not only recycle, but where everything needed to go. And here's a young guy with gallon cans strapped to his feet, stomping along, making audio incredible attention gathering. And what else?
Well, that was Trash Man. I remember that one well.
The Trash
Man. That activity didn't go over so well at Iowa State when we did it in the dumpsters at Iowa State. They didn't like that as much. Yeah. But that was part of our environmental education. And I mean, we took the actual kids' garbage that they made over the week of the camp. And myself and one of our other staff members, whoever got volunteered for it, would dress up in those garbage suits and we'd dump out the week's trash and we'd find out how much was really should have been recycled and what should have been composted, and then had fun with it too. And one of the parts I really loved is we used to hide like a sandwich. We would wrap it up and make sure that it was sanitary. And then when the kids were all around and we were going through all the garbage, we'd pull out the special sandwich, and then we'd eat it right in front of them so that they could see that, you know, it's not all waste. But yeah, those types of activities, we just love doing them with the kids. They were so influential. And I bet there's kids out there that still remember, well, they're adults now, that still remember Trash Man dumping out the week's worth of the garbage.
I forgot what you called yourself, but I can still see the spectacle. So this was a springboard, if you will, into your, again, your grown-up activities. You're a teacher now?
Yes. Yep. I teach biology at high school level right now. And like, I still try to bring those things into the classroom. Maybe not dumping garbage all over my own classroom, but we had camp, we had all of the touch tables and all that kind of stuff. So in our classroom now, in my classroom, I have fish tanks, I have hydroponics, I have anything that the kids could build with just to keep
them
interested.
Well, you mentioned a touch table. So interesting pieces of nature. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes. Yep. When anything we would collect out on hikes, we would just put it on tables in the community room and let kids explore it. So if they didn't happen to see it, you know, when they were out hiking.
Yeah. Deer antlers, the turtle
deer
shells.
Antlers,
yeah.
That's excellent. Sort of all the things. Yep.
A touch table. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And encourage kids to touch it.
So what was it like to work with this woman, Terry Hofer?
Terry.
Be nice.
Oh, Terry and I, we worked there for what, 6-7 years together, Terry?
Oh, well, not that. Well,
it was
I
amazing.
Total,
Terry was
total.
Always the breath of fresh naturalist. She was out there, you know, doing activities and just getting the kids excited about it. And she was always a little bit more mature than the rest of us, so she kind of kept us in line.
So, Randy Farnham, what does this mean to you that this 4-H camp is now going to be essentially remain in public ownership?
I'm super excited. I was extremely nervous that it would end up being some kind of development or go into something unreclaimable. But to see it going back into the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation and the DNR, I know that in, 9 or 10 years that I lived out there and worked out there off and on, I never even got to explore every corner of it, you know, and I know through the different staff members, and we get together and we talk, and they're like, do you remember going in this, you know, going up this ravine? And I'm like, we never went up that ravine. There's still more places to explore. Mm-hmm. And to know that that will be there in perpetuity now, that's super. And mm-hmm. I it's starting off like SOAR was out there. And if we can have those activities keep going, a whole new generation of people coming through are going to experience it. You know, they'll experience it different. We experienced it as residential camping. Pioneers experienced it as farming 100 years ago. Native Americans experienced it for thousands of years before that in different ways. Mm-hmm. And so it's just super exciting to me that it's going into another development phase, but it's the natural development of it. It's not mm-hmm. concrete and houses. It's going to be the ravines and the water and the creek stomping and everything beautiful about the area being preserved.
Yeah, let's live long lives, and hopefully our paths will come together out there. And you have children to take there now?
I have 3 children. I have one that's actually in college now, Pat. So, yep, and 2 that are in middle school. And I was hoping that they were going to get to go with us on that work day this summer, but it was the first one. So they'll be going up with us for our volunteer days that we host at the camp to try and, you know, pick up after the derecho and then get it back into it growing stages.
So it sounds like our paths will come together. Wow, that's
I'm hoping so. See, cool. This is just the first start of it coming back together.
All right. All right. Well, Terry, any enlightenment on this Randy Farnham showcase of individual that you were able to work with?
Oh, where do I start, Randy? Randy is one of those special people. You were a camp counselor when I first met you, right, Randy? Yeah.
I did a little bit of everything.
He did everything. And then I left and came back as program director, and he was on staff. But Randy is, as you can tell, has so much energy and enthusiasm and passion. And he was so instrumental and had such an impact on children out there. You know, just an amazing human being.
Effervescent comes to mind. And maybe like Speedy the Alka-Seltzer guy, you know. Or is there anything else, Randy Farnham?
Just the people like Terry and Pat, when you and I were together in the DNR, and Mark and Mike.
Oh, Mark Edwards, you know, sure.
Yeah. Mark Edwards, yep, with the DNR. And Terry and Dave wouldn't be here with us tonight. Just so influential in that early part of growing up and making us what we are. And now it's so exciting to see, you know, the staff members running different nature centers and mm-hmm. being part of the DNR and actually being in the management parts of the DNR. You know, we made ourselves into leadership positions. So that's exciting to see everybody that blossomed into those places.
Well, we're certainly fortunate that an area that's it sounds like it really touched your heart and Terry's heart and a lot of essentially just everybody that ever went there. So it's what a legacy that you've forged and continue, and may it always continue. Thank you, Randy Farnham.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you, Terry. And I can't wait to see you guys out there. We'll guise it as volunteer work days, and we'll have a lot of fun also.
Yeah. Yeah, and just so you know, Randy, I got some people to sign up to be on the Friends of 4-H Camp.
You've been listening to a recent gathering of conservationists at the 4-H Camp, southwest of Ames along the Des Moines River. Staff members Terry Hofer and Randy Farnham gave their impressions of having gotten their start in their professional life at the 4-H Camp. So you can look forward to additional stories about the transitioning of this cherished area. And a new organization that Terry mentioned is the Friends of the 4-H Camp. I'll be anxious to keep those workday developments. And what a great story. Thank you, Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, for putting it all together. And Abby Terpstra, there that oversees that outreach for the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. And Derek, their land manager. It's just a great story. So we'll learn more in the months ahead. This is KHOY Community Radio's Local Talk, and I'm Pat Schlarbaum, today with our engineer, Mike Murphy. Hey, let's welcome Susan Guiazda, Public Relations Officer with the City of Ames. Hi, Susan.
Hey, Pat.
Great to have you with us once again. Before we introduce your guests, do you have any announcements for the city?
Just a couple of things. Just a reminder, next Tuesday is our regularly scheduled city council meeting that starts at 6 p.m. And those are held in person at the city council chambers, City Hall, 515 Clark. And another event to put on your calendar is Tuesday, October 19th. We're going to be having a bike infrastructure workshop with the city council, which is kind of an overview of the bike infrastructure we have in the city. We'll have representatives from Iowa State University, Facilities Planning and Management, as well as Story County and the Ames Community School District, kind of giving an overview of how the bike trail infrastructure all works together in Story County. So that should be an interesting workshop. That, again, is 6 p.m. on Tuesday, October 19th at the council chambers as well. Those meetings are streamed off our website, off Facebook Live, and off YouTube Live.
That's a great story. I see the green bike lanes kind of springing up around town. Will that be discussed at the meeting on October 19th also?
Yeah, we'll talk about the different kinds of, there's on-street bike lanes, off-street bike lanes, commuter lanes, recreational lanes. We'll sort of talk about the whole philosophy behind Complete Streets. And you know what, Pat, you're giving me a great idea. I'm going to try to schedule Damian Pregitzer, our traffic engineer, to come in next week and talk on KHOI about that workshop. So that'll be something we can share with all your listeners. Look forward to next week where we can talk about their opportunities to educate themselves and actually advocate. So we'll get that scheduled for next week. This is just an advanced some advanced education.
Exactly. It's sharing the road. We're modifying some of our previous ways of getting around town, and it's welcoming the bicycles. I think it's great.
Well, I think that's a great segue into sustainability and some of the things that we are looking at with climate action planning. So I know that Mary has a lot of information to share. Yeah. There's so much stuff going on around the community.
Hi, Mary Rankin. Hi.
Always a pleasure to join you.
It's always a pleasure to see your smiling face as the sustainability director for the City of Ames and Iowa State University.
Yes, Pat, it's always a pleasure to join KHOI and talk about sustainability. And as Susan mentioned, so much going on right now related to climate action planning for our community. Mm-hmm. And very exciting that actually just a couple of days ago, it seems like it happened a while ago, but we had our first supplemental input gathering with all of those committee members from our community that have applied through application and was selected by mayor and council in order to represent all of our different community sectors in this process. And through that meeting, we had our consultants join us. We went through basically the planning process and a real in-depth look at business as usual. If we continue to do the same activities in the same way within our community, what our greenhouse gas emissions will look like in 20 years by 2050. And I thought there was great discussion by our sector members, very thoughtful questions, and just a really great opportunity to join. Another thing that I would mention about this activity, or excuse me, I guess our time together was an activity that we did, and it's an activity that is also available, and we really encourage anyone in the community and everyone in the community to take part in this. And so what we did was we did a bit of a reflecting and visioning exercise. Okay. And this was something where there's a series of questions, and we had our supplemental input committee members respond to those questions. And these were questions that reflected back on what we're really proud of in our community and what we have been really excited about that our community has accomplished. Mm-hmm. And then we did some visioning, and that was related to, you know, based upon the great infrastructure and the great amenities and all the great components of our community. Mm-hmm. What is possible? You know, what is your vision for our community in the future? Oh, go ahead, Pat.
Oh, I'm just real curious about what are some of the attributes that came up in your supplemental input committee. What are some of those bright lights? And then I think you're going to go to where what else can be done. But
What are a couple of those highlights that you feel are important for Ames?
Well, I personally would offer you some pieces that the committee came up with. I certainly have my own personal things, but I think it was really exciting and, oh my gosh, really reminded me even of all the number of pieces that we really have in our community. So there were things listed like our park system, like the fact that, you know, we have electric vehicle charging stations. We have our solar project now in place. We are relying on wind as well as now solar energy in our portfolio. And of course, since 1975, we have offered a really unique way of approaching garbage and not just landfilling it. But then the people, you know, many responses were the people of our community, the different perspectives that they bring, the different experiences that they have had that they bring to our community. And of course, I'm pretty biased about this one. Iowa State University was mentioned. All the many different students that we have coming in from around the world, and then also all the incredible speakers that come in, you know, through our lecture series. Susan, were there any other ones that you thought were particularly interesting in that exercise?
I think, Mary, you hit it with the idea that one of our greatest assets is people, that we have an educated population that is interested and passionate about making change. And I think there's a sense of urgency that this is an issue that we need to tackle now. We can't kick the can down the road. So that was important. I know the group was a bit biased because, honestly, if you've applied to be part of a supplemental input committee surrounding climate action planning, you're probably extremely interested in the topic, but it was great feedback.
Yeah, and I'd like to include your Environmental Appreciation Day when you gathered all the conservation leaders that work for the City of Ames and put together that pretty big day. And those archives are available, but something to build on there also.
And Pat, I think you bring up a perfect segue to offer our listeners the opportunity that you can put your voice into this exercise through the City of Ames website, now specifically devoted to climate action planning. I just want to note, and I'll make sure we note before we sign off today, that website is cityofames.org/sustainability. Mm-hmm. And that is our primary sustainability page. But on that page, you will notice a specific button for climate action plan. Mm-hmm. And when you go on to there, it notes how to stay connected, how to get involved. And it offers to be able to take part in this visioning exercise. And if you just click right on that button, it will take you to these questions. And, you know, this plan will be only as successful as we have fully brought together all of the interests, all the perspectives, and all the visions and hopes for our collective community. So we really encourage everyone to go out and add their perspective and their vision to this through that process. And of course, there are ways, so many more ways coming up. So this is our, you know, sort of our foundation reflection visioning process. But a number of engagement opportunities are happening. And one that I want to make sure gets on our listeners' calendars is our first town hall meeting with this process. So the public is invited to take part in this. The consultants will, again, be going through the process, talking about the modeling, talking about all the facets and all the many people giving their time formally to this process, but then how to also informally make sure that, you know, your voice is heard. And that's going to be taking place on Monday, the 25th of October. It will be in council chambers, and it kicks off at 6 p.m., and we also will be providing streaming opportunities for folks that aren't able to attend in person or prefer not to attend in person. There will be the opportunity to still join and see everything that's happening. And of course, we will tape that and include that in archives within the website so that people can catch up and stay informed at any time.
Save that date, October 25th, 6 p.m. And how about just a couple visions that have been rising to the surface? We've got a couple minutes here.
Yeah, so I would say, you know, some that I remember from that process was increasing the amount of renewables within our energy portfolio, continuing to, you know, build our green spaces and have those available, looking at how we can have increased native species, you know, pollinator species, you know, continue to be supporting throughout the community.
I think, again, there was interest in expanding the bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure. So again, people, we're a multimodal community, so we need to offer people who choose not to drive options, expanding our EV infrastructure so people who choose electric vehicles can continue to be comfortable on that road. And I think there was just a huge spectrum of different ideas of what Ames could look like in the future, where we can accommodate everybody.
Oh, this is great planning. The Supplemental Input Committee that's a part of the climate action planning process. Boy, it's great to have conservation leaders like Mary Rankin and Susan Guiasta on Local Talk occasionally to address these really important, as you say, visionary concepts that we can take into our futures.
Yeah, and Pat, I would just say, of course, this is a team effort. So our community team comes together, our community team determines what our future looks like. And based upon this first discussion with our Supplemental Input Committee, I am really excited for what this process will bring about and for the future that that our community is excited to embark upon. And just a reminder, Pat, that website, cityofames.org /sustainability. And also on that page, there is a link if you want to submit your email and be kept up to date on different upcoming events and different pieces of the planning process, how that's updating, please feel free to sign on and keep updated in that way as well.
Oh, that's just great. Thank you, Mary Rankin. Thank you, Susan Guiasta. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Pat. Thanks for letting us come in and share these stories. Oh. We appreciate what you do
It is a team effort, isn't that for sure? Oh, great T-shirt there, Mary Rankin. She's got one of the KHOI T-shirts on today. Gotta love it. Hey, but we've got another story before the closing the hour. Thank you so much again, Mary and Susan. Virginia Nichols is providing Local Talk with commentary by the Practical Farmers of Iowa organization. And here's an installment that's entitled, Not Even a Carp.
Not Even a Carp.
In the spring of 1960, when I was 6 years old, we went to one of our favorite spots on the Platte River. The water in the Platte was usually pretty clear, and normally you could see the bottom. But on this day, the water was cloudy, yellowish brown. I was mad because we didn't even catch a carp that day. Dad explained to me that it must have rained somewhere upstream and that soil had washed into the river. On the way home, Dad pointed to the rills and small gullies in the bare farm fields of eastern Nebraska that were ready to plant. Dad said that those gullies were caused by erosion and that when it rained, soil was washing off the fields and into the river. I noticed that the color of the soil in the fields was the same yellowish-brown color that the water in the river had been that day. I decided I didn't like erosion very much because it ruined the fishing. Years later, as a teenager in the 1970s, I ended up at Iowa State University studying biology. I wanted to be a wildlife biologist and work in fisheries management, but I soon found out that there were a lot of other people that wanted to be wildlife biologists, and there weren't many jobs. That was pretty discouraging. Later, I happened to get a part-time job working for some USDA scientists on campus that were studying erosion and water conservation. This turned out to be a great job for me because I enjoyed working outside and I spent my time taking soil samples, plant samples, and helping with the field work. The scientists I work for explained to me that over 80% of the land area in Iowa is farmland, and that the water quality in Iowa's streams is pretty much determined by how farmland is managed. So I thought that maybe if I kept working with this group and going to school for just a few more years, I could possibly get a job working in ag research to improve water quality. Well, a few more years turned into 8 more years, and eventually I was hired as a scientist in 1981. In the 80s, our research group worked mostly on erosion and no-till. In the mid-80s, construction started on our new lab on the Iowa State campus. The lab was originally called the Soil Tilth Lab, and it opened in 1989. Soon after the opening, we had a big meeting with people from across the Midwest to discuss the kind of research the lab should be working on. One of the speakers was Jim Ann from Iowa NRCS. Jim said that Iowa farmers were not going to be able to grow soybeans in some fields because of the new erosion limits in the 1985 Farm Bill. He told us that somebody at the lab should work on cover crops to reduce erosion after soybeans. The erosion limits that Jim mentioned were later scaled back by Congress, but that really didn't solve the problem. Later that year, I attended a field day at Dick Thompson's farm near Boone, Iowa. Dick was one of the founding members of Practical Farmers of Iowa, and Dick showed me that farmers could grow cover crops with corn and soybeans in Iowa. So with that encouragement, I applied for and obtained some funding from the Leopold Center at Iowa State and began my first cover crop research project in the summer of 1990. My initial work with cover crops mainly revolved around learning how to plant, grow, and terminate cover crops in a corn and soybean rotation. But in farming or science, you sometimes learn things by accident. For example, one year we had a winter rye cover crop growing in the far corner of a farmer's harvested cornfield. In late October, the farmer and I were looking at the rye, and it was growing up really thick and dark green. At this point, the farmer casually mentions to me that he was going to put a few head of cattle out in the field to pick up dropped corn. He told me, "The cattle won't bother the cover crops way over here because the water tank is in the other corner of the field, almost a mile away." I came back several weeks later to measure how much the rye had grown. I walked out into the field carrying all my equipment, and as I got closer to the corner of the field, I couldn't see the rye. It was gone. The cattle had grazed it to the ground. At first I was mad, but then I had to laugh. I realized I had discovered something by accident. I had discovered that cattle really love to eat rye cover crops. This was probably not a big surprise to most farmers, and today, many farmers in Iowa use winter rye cover crops to increase grazing acres while still growing corn and soybeans. After our initial experiments showed us that we could reliably grow cover crops as long as we kept cattle away from them, we decided to see if cover crops reduced erosion. To do this, we planted winter rice in strips on a sloping field in the fall after no-till soybeans. We also left some strips without cover crops. The cover crops grew really well, and the following April, we went out to this field to make erosion measurements. Because you can never count on it to rain when you want it to, we hauled water tanks and pumps out to the field to make artificial rain. We dug pits at the bottom of the slope to collect runoff and sediment. Naturally, it was cold and windy, that week while we were raining. Even wearing rain suits, we were getting cold, wet, and muddy. But I was really excited because I could see right away that the water coming off the strips with the dark green rye cover crops was clean and clear. It looked like you could drink it. At the same time, the water coming off the no-till strips without cover crops was cloudy, brown, and definitely not drinkable. That brown water reminded me of the water in the Platte River after a spring rain. Our measurements confirmed what we could see with our eyes. The rye cover crop reduced erosion to about 1 ton per acre per year. That still sounds like a lot, but it is way less than the Iowa average erosion rate of 5.7 tons per acre per year. This means that over 35 years, a cover crop and no-till could save an estimated 1 inch of topsoil, prevent 2 bushel per acre decrease in average corn yields, and save $665 in crop and fertilizer losses. It also means that with cover crops and no-till, farmers could grow soybeans on hilly ground without too much erosion. Later, in the mid-90s, there were growing concerns in Iowa and the Midwest about nitrate contamination of water. First, there was concern about nitrate in farm wells, then nitrate in municipal water supplies, and later, nitrate in the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico. I had read about research in the Chesapeake Bay area that had shown that rye cover crops could reduce seepage of nitrate into the bay. So we decided to try the same thing in Iowa. In 1999, scientists at my lab set up a field study with 24 small fields that each had their own separate drainage tile so that we could collect, measure, analyze all the drainage water coming from each of those fields for nitrate. Some of those small fields had a corn-soybean rotation with no-till and a winter rye cover crop every year. In the 19 years since this field setup became operational, the winter rye cover crop has reduced the amount of nitrate lost in tile drainage by an average of 57%, or by about 20 pounds of nitrogen per acre per year. This means that 20 pounds of nitrogen was recycled back into the soil every year and didn't end up in our drinking water or the Gulf of Mexico. We also learned that a lot of the nitrate in the drainage water was coming from the soil and not directly from the nitrogen fertilizer applied to corn. We concluded that the biggest factor in reducing nitrate losses was having the green living cover crop plants growing and taking up nitrogen during the late fall, winter, and early spring, when normally nothing is growing in our fields. The last piece of the cover crop puzzle fell into place after we had cover crops growing in some of our fields for a number of years. We could go to a cover crop field and dig up a shovel full of soil and see that it was filled with roots and worm holes. It had a rich, moist, earthy smell. You could feel the soil crumble in your hands, and you could see that the soil was alive and moving with worms and other small organisms. Some people call this soil health, but whatever you call it, we could see, feel, and smell the difference. After 10 years, we could measure more soil organic matter, more worms, more soil nitrogen, more water storage capacity, more rain infiltration, and more soil life. Sometimes this better soil lets us get into the field sooner after a rain because it drains faster and doesn't pond as much. Better, healthier soil also helps corn or soybeans withstand our crazy Iowa weather, the big 4-inch rains, the wet springs, and the 6-week dry spells in the summer. The conclusion I came to from all this research is that cover crops work because they keep green living plants out in corn and soybean fields during the brown months between harvest and planting. I believe that cover crops are worth the time and money because they are a long-term investment in improving and protecting our soils and water for our children and grandchildren. And the exciting thing is, we have barely scratched the surface of the potential of cover crops. For example, there has been almost no plant breeding or selection done to improve cover crops, and the potential for better cover crops is huge. I believe that cover crops can keep our fields green and our water clean, but does anyone else believe that? When you work on ag research, you often get asked to talk to farmers at field days and winter meetings. At first, I was not really very comfortable doing that. I was way more comfortable talking to other scientists about data and experiments. I didn't know if farmers would want to hear about cover crops from someone who grew up in Omaha. But it turned out to be okay. Most farmers are generally interested in hearing about how they can protect and improve their land. Over the years, I've heard farmers make comments like, "I have to use cover crops because I can't stand seeing the erosion on my hills. My farm has some of the poorest soils in the county, and I want to make them better. I just like seeing the green out there in the winter and the spring." It's the right thing to do. Finally, the best indication that farmers are beginning to believe in cover crops is the dramatic increase in cover crop acres in Iowa. In 1990, there were almost no cover crops in Iowa, and in 2019, there were almost 1 million acres. That's tremendous progress. Unfortunately, that still leaves 23 million acres of corn and soybeans without cover crops. At our current rate of adoption, it will take us another 600 years to protect the rest of those acres with cover crops. Hopefully, it won't take that long. In any case, that's how a love of fishing led me to work on cover crops. And maybe someday when we go fishing with our great-grandchildren, the water won't turn cloudy when it rains upstream.
This story was written by Tom Casper with the help of Tina Bakehouse. Tom was a plant physiologist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, but now he is retired. Tina is a communication educator, executive coach, storyteller, and creative. Blue Dot Sessions provided all of the music for this episode. This podcast is part two of a three-part series titled Consider the Soil. The series was created and produced by me, Gina Nichols, with support from a North Central Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education graduate student grant, and of course, the Practical Farmers of Iowa.
Thank you, Virginia Nichols, on your Soil Health Podcast. This is KHOI, Story City, Ames. Thank you, Local Talk producers Ursula Rudenberg and Lynn Carey, and thank you, Dennis Hart, with your Friday report. Thank you, engineer Mike Murphy, and thanks to our guests Kay Newman, Abby Terpstra, Randy Farnham, Terry Hofer, Susan Guiazda, Mary Rankin, Tom Casper, and Gina Nichols. I have been your host for this hour, Pat Schlarbaum. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other artists you heard was Doug Wood, In Our Hands. Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Be the community in community radio. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.